Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Today we are very happy to welcome Dr. Alexander Cummins, author of Nazarth, Pillars of Gladness, a geomancer's angelical psalter of cores containing vessels 19 with which to water the earth. In this episode of the Hadean podcast, Al and I discuss the panoply of influences which coalesce to produce this text, the origins of geomancy, the work of Dr. D and Edward Kelly, which became the multifaceted practice of modern Enochian magic, the Edenic Tongue and Mythic Adam, and the methodologies which constellated to create this received and refined Psalter of Calls, which Dr. Cummins recommends for use with our own explorations in the realm of practical geomancy and divination. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Dr. Alexander Cummins to the Hadean Press podcast.
Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me. It's great to be here and have a chat with you, Matt.
Al, you have been more than just an inspiration to me over the years, taking your classes, receiving your guidance, and reading your works such as the excellent book of The Art of Magic by yourself and Phil Leggard have been particularly instrumental in the method and shape of my own personal practice. And for that, I have to give you a genuinely heartfelt thank you.
Oh, bless you. Thank you very much.
So Al, I think I've listened to more than a few interviews with you over the years, and without necessarily asking you for a definitive description of your personal practice, could you describe something of your approach to magic for our audience?
Sure, yeah. I think one of the things that is increasingly becoming apparent for me is a deep abiding influence. We can start from that point, like influence from study of the various pre-modern folk magicians, service magicians, local spirit workers, and wise women that get called collectively cunning folk, and the traditions of English folk magic from the early modern period specifically are a huge influence on me, and increasingly feeling that my practice is rooted in that, really, which can have expression in the kinds of divination I do, which is mostly geomancy, European Renaissance geomancy, as well as my engagement with grimoric materials and working with manuals of spirit conjuration, as well as being very invested in work with the dead, both like ancestor work and also the local dead of your nearest cemetery, as well as like the quote great dead of like particularly inspiring tutelary shades and things like that. And so, yeah, I guess those are the three streams that I tend to find my work most coherent to myself, shall we say. Yeah, geomancy, folk necromancy, and cunning craft.
Interesting. So today we are specifically talking about your most recent book from Hadean Press. I say book, I think Psalter would perhaps be a better term to describe it. You've named it Nazarth, Pillars of Gladness, or a geomancer's angelical psalter of calls containing vessels 19 of which to water the earth, which is an absolutely fantastic title, bristling with magic and strong overtones of Enochiana and Gematria. I think we could spend most of this hour together discussing exactly what all of this means specifically, but in brief, could you describe what a psalter is and what is the meaning of Nazarth and the Pillars of Gladness?
Sure. Yeah. So a psalter in general is a collection of psalms or prayers or orisons There's a little bit of overlap when you start to get into like folk Catholic practice with it being like a book of calls, which like grimoire magicians and witches in your audience will be very familiar with this idea of like a book from which you do your conjurations and calls. And that itself has crossover into like a Liber Spiritum, a beneficially haunted book that isn't just a reference material full of ritual scripts, but is actually like a place that you conjure your spirits out of, so to speak. So a psalter, it's a collection of prayers, it's a collection of calls or invocations, incantations, if we don't want to get into that technical, what's an invocation, what's an evocation, which is a relatively more recent distinction. You don't see that as much in pre-modern texts. The idea of it is hopefully pretty straightforward, if I can land the explication. It's 19 prayers, calls is probably the most accurate term, which are designed to help a practitioner divine and do operative magic, mostly based around the system of European Renaissance geomancy that I'm most familiar with. The idea is that there are 16 calls in there that cohere, activate, summon, and potentially send forth the spirits and virtues associated with each of the 16 answers or figures that can be derived from Renaissance geomancy, and also three calls for more utilitarian purposes. The first for opening any kind of divination at all, the last for closing divination and for expressing gratitude for your spirits and guides for helping you, and then one for clearing what gets called a halted chart, which, without getting into too much depth, geomancy has a really deeply held idea that not every time is good to ask every question. And when one of those 16 figures crops up first in a reading, we abandon the chart because it is a sign not only of potential for deception, it's also a kind of a red alert warning of the capacity of for us to deceive ourselves about this matter. And so when a chart is halted like that, when you're doing a reading and this figure, which is called Rubius, the red one, crops up, we abandon the chart. We might do some reading about like why that's going on, but generally we abandon it and maybe reformulate the question tomorrow once you've like taken a salt bath, or sometimes a lot of stuff is needed to clear that kind of energy so that you can get a helpful answer. Sometimes not a lot at all. Sometimes it's very obvious. I've been reading professionally geomancy for clients for a good while now, over a decade. And the answer, the reasons as to why that comes up are varied. You know, someone's been mucking about in a graveyard and brought some hopalongs home with them, to just like no idea why it just so happens that way. And so anyway, there is a call in here to clear the energies of a halted chart, and in really any chart that is confusing us to the point of worrying us, not just I don't understand what this is, I'm scratching my head, but that gets us genuinely worried or afraid, which can happen when you're reading about serious things. And so it is Nazarth is a collection of 19 partially like received or channeled texts involving these prayers or these calls in English, as well as the angelical language that gets called Enochian.
When you say that a chart could be halted, is that similar to astrology, where you have via combustor?
This is not necessarily a good time to do some things. Yeah, potentially. Yeah, it has crossover with like weather conditions. Some geomantic handbooks recommend you not read while there's a storm going on and that kind of thing. So yeah, I'd say they were related. And European Renaissance geomancy is a lot closer to certainly Western practices of astrology as well. Geomancy comes from Ramel, Arabic sand divination or cutting into sand. And one of the many things that happens is these 10th and 11th century.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Arabic diviners, as well as merchants and booksellers, spread the good ground news of geomancy. It gets even more heavily astrologized by Europeans, who then take it and run with it in that direction.
So the astrological components of Renaissance geomancy have been added to it over time. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it looks that way. If we are to compare it to various traditions of Ramel of Arabic geomancy, the kind of father of all of those other systems, there is some evidence that it may have its roots in astrology. Certainly, what we can say by the early modern period is that geomancy is said to be practiced by the use and rules of astrology. It gets called a sister or a daughter of astrology sometimes. And what that means, practically speaking, is if you know your four elements, your seven planets, and maybe even your 12 zodiacal signs, certainly your 12 houses, then you are most of the way to understanding how European Renaissance geomancy works, which is essentially a kind of dirt astrology that revolves around sortilege, around flipping coins, throwing lots, various ways of determining the figures themselves, which are then interpreted according to what we could call correspondences. So each of the 16 figures is ruled by at least one of the seven planets, and various different astrologers ascribe in their own idiosyncratic ways correspondences to different zodiacal signs as well.
Yeah, it's something I'm really interested in becoming more familiar with, because it's a bit of a blank in my knowledge right now. But yeah, I'm very curious to learn about it. And I think maybe your book, while not necessarily being like an introduction to geomancy, really gives an audience an understanding of how geomancy can be applied.
It partly emerged out of like a professional need that I was reading for clients using this geomantic oracle, and also looking for magical remediations when that was appropriate, not just, you know, saying like, this is the forecast, oops, all towers, good luck with that, but being able to look at, can we do something about this? And again, geomancy is really good at assessing, if I'm trying to achieve so and so, what do I need to do now to do that? And it can also, as you develop your nuance in reading, be able to tell like whether or not it's saying, yeah, you can definitely do magic about this. It'll be super simple. It'll be super easy. One offering at a crossroads, boom, it's all done. To, oh, this is going to take time and effort and a consistency of practice, versus there's really not a lot you can do about this. This is about enduring this like latest tidal wave of whatever's going on. And you can pick apart all of that stuff. And what it emerged from was being able to highlight, okay, here are a couple of figures or spirits of associated with those figures, those answers that are coming forth that are marking helpful, beneficial progress and spiritual development for you, or towards a very concrete aim of, you know, getting my boss to stop being a jerk or whatever it is. Having these calls to be able to like prescribe them and say, hey, read this at this hour over a candle or a variety of other things, and this should help. So they were partly very much designed to be practical and to get people getting under the hood and playing with the magic of geomancy as well as its strict divination.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier about having like ritual baths with them. Yeah, they seem to be highly practical in nature, as opposed to, you know, the more, you know, cerebral or ceremonial style of magic. They're more in the dirt, not necessarily in a negative sense. I mean that they're very much you know, the part of the easily manipulated things in the world, like materia and things that you can bring into a ritual space and utilize immediately. Is there necessarily anything that the practitioner needs to know about, say, like magical timing or anything in relation to the geomantic characters? Or is it that they can be utilized at any time?
Yeah, this is one of the big differences between geomancy and astrology. I would argue that astrology is, you know, is a kind of time magic, right? Like as Proclus says, and as Agrippa loves to quote, time is the motion of the celestial bodies. And it's absolutely, you know, about the time that you ask the question. That's the basis of like horary reading, as well as like electing a suitable time to do something or not do something. Geomancy is more like space magic or place magic. I think we could argue it is very much engaged in the grassroots bottom up of working with the virtues of the the seeds of the stars, as the prayer of the gnomes says, like that are in the earth already. The idea that like we are dealing with ultimately, you know, worldly things. That's what the geo and geomancy means. It doesn't just refer to like one quarter of the four classical elements. It's an oracle of worldly affairs, of things that happen on, just under, and just over the earth, right? The whole world. And so it doesn't have as many strictures around timing. That said, certainly the way I read geomancy is very much informed by a lot of planetary folk magic, a lot of work with the ruling spirits of the planets, you know, Kedemel, etc. And I will say that, like, as an added component, being able to time at least by planetary day and hour is incredibly useful. So if you're going to work with a Jupiterian figure of, let's say, you know, creativity and revitalization, Laetitia, which translates as joy, right, or gladness sometimes, which is especially good. I read it as a watery figure, is especially good for baths to revitalize us and help us feel new and hopeful again. Then doing that with a you know, in a on a Thursday in a Jupiterian hour is even more effective. And there is a there's an interesting set of relationships when we get into the spirits of like the ruling spirits and how they fuel the unfolding influence of the patterns that are cohered and understood as the 16 figures.
Nazarth begins with a hauntingly beautiful poem from a true and faithful relation of what passed for many years between John Dee, Dr. John Dee, and some spirits, which you kindly narrated for the promotional video Hadian produced for this text. Would you like to read this once more for our audience?
Absolutely, sure, yeah. And thank you for priming me that you're going to ask me that. Yeah, so I have the book to hand, yeah. It's a quote from Marika Salvin, who writes this, yeah, character assassination of Dee, basically. That's mostly what a true and faithful relation is kind of known for, historically speaking, as well as being one of the first places that a lot of Dee's material was reported on and made available. It seems a lot of folks, a lot of cunning folk, gathered it and used it and had it on their shelves to get at some of the Enochian magics, which is, again, not to go too far on a tangent here, but it's one of the things that fascinates me about the middle period between what gets called Dee Purism, of like what literally Dr. Dee did in his Enochian stuff, and then the Golden Dawn's later extrapolations with all their colorful tables and charts and so on. I'm really interested in the intermediary period of the early modern, where you do get Enochian names of God being found in other works. And that's really what I'm interested in terms of what I might call like Enochian folk magic. We can get into that, more of that later. Anyway, so the piece of Casaubon that I really liked and wanted to start the book off with is this quote here. "Wisdom sitteth upon a hill and beholdeth the four winds and girdeth herself together as the brightness of the morning, which is visited with a few and dwelleth alone as though she were a widow."
Thank you. That's so beautiful. And there's so much really interesting imagery that's conjured up by that. Could you say something about what these words mean to you and why you included them?
Yeah, I mean, they are very much emergent from not just reading these texts for the evidence of what Spirit said, but also reading them.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
With spirits, like ritually summoning and calling, and then reading texts aloud together, and this sense of like who gathers around you while you are looking at the thing, right? Who are the other spirits that also venerated that thing, which is a huge part of my approach to talking to spirits and forging relationships with them in general. I can definitely speak of some of it. I mean, the idea of beginning with an appeal to the four winds is a big important part of my practice and how I begin an awful lot of stuff in general. And I know, speaking to you, that's also something that you're very much aware of in general, and also some of the specifics of where the animoi or the winds can also be the seasons on the one hand, if we're going to go the kind of Hellenistic route, but also definitely kind of evoke for me the four cardinal or demonic kings or regents that underlie an awful lot of at least early modern Goetia. And I know are dear to you as well, Matt.
So could you speak more about that? I mean, specifically in regard to how you work with geomancy?
Sure, yeah. I mean, so for a start, the idea of orienting ourselves at the beginning of a book with an appeal to where are you? What is your orientation? Where are you facing? Like, are you, what is the rising sun of East to you right now? Is very important. I think my opening rituals often for a lot of work often involve appeal. You know, it's quarters, right? Like if it was good enough for the Babylonians, it should be good enough for us, right? And so for me, doing that isn't just about paying lip service to an extra layer or set of spirits. It's about being able to orient myself, my body and my calling voice in space and time, and to be able to draw on the licensing buffs and empowerments that calling the cardinal quarters in general, and for me the four kings offers for that stuff. It's not just a bunch of spirits I go to about some very specific Goetia. It's how I consider calling and sending spirits out more generally, and also, you know, calling them in to consider how we're going to work on this next grimoire together, how we're going to piece together the bits and pieces of how to work a specific remediation for a client. And so that comes with bringing in a lot of the divination and the charts I do in geomancy to be able to understand this is the issue. Here are the measurements of the spirits of this oracle that have gone out and said, this is what's helpful and this is what's not going to be helpful. This is the likelihood of when this pattern meets this pattern, what the synthesis will be. And then from there, being able to look at like, okay, where are the points of transmutability, as Andrew Chumbly likes to put it, right? Where are the moments where sorceress intervention can be ideally as lazy as possible, right? Doing the least amount of work for the most amount of effort. And so calling in big, powerful, ancient, kingly spirits of the directions is a very effective way of ensuring that you're batting with the best support you can.
And this idea of wisdom sitting upon a hill, is that a reference to, say, Sophia?
I mean, when we're talking about wisdom, we're always like potentially able to like port between different models of how anthropomorphized or otherwise it is, as well as like particular traditions of it. I think increasingly for me, the idea of divination and magic segue into each other, you know, even if we're talking about like the simplicity of like a tarot reading where you have a significator card, where you're like, I identify with this card as being like addressing me and being able to find myself in this position. That is a, you know, that's a kind of magic once you take that significator and like put it in your pocket to like give you good luck on your day out, or like put it up on your altar to consider it. So the way divination seeks it seamlessly into sorcery, right? You've laid out you've created the taxons of different elements of reality, right? You know, ideally, you're able to plot out a model of what's going to happen or what is currently happening by whatever system of divination you're using, right? Certainly the computational ones like astrology and geomancy. And then from there, being able to find ways for that to make sense. So like, on the one hand, they're not so separate. And the other part is it seems to be increasingly about cohering wise action, right? Wisdom is not just knowing a bunch of things. It's also knowing when to duck, right? It's knowing how to apply that knowledge. And so the idea of like seeking clarity, if you don't know what else to pray for health and pray for clarity, and the rest of that can follow from there. So the idea of divination bringing a light into the darkness of confusion, and fighting against that confusion in ourselves and outside of ourselves, is also, you know, something that can be supported by talismans to make, you know, to help you sharpen your divination or increase your spirit contact or deepen your spirit communion, as well as like actual rites of, you know, illumination and empowerment. An appeal to wisdom, I think, is crucial if you're going to talk about a text that's for divination specifically, and also more generally for hopefully magic that helps people live wiser lives.
For those listening who aren't familiar with the Enochian system of magic, could you briefly describe something of it and how you work with it?
Yeah, for sure. So the systems, plural, that get called Enochian magic are derived from the work of Dr. John Dee, court magi to magus to Elizabeth I. He famously sets her coronation date by an astrological election, and is involved in a bunch of other things. But crucially, throughout the 1580s, he's doing a set of angelical or spiritual operations, and channels a number of systems and texts from the Heptarchia to the Book of Soiga, however you, like, various ways of pronouncing that, to a bunch of other texts. It's usually acknowledged that there are at least two or three interrelated systems of Enochian magic, and they are often commented as being particularly apt for a cryptographer, as Dee was, very much in the vein of Trithemius, etc., that these systems often rely on these very complicated tables and the modular nature of its angelic spirits, as well as a bunch of apocalypticism and kind of revelation, and a sprinkling of Kabbalah and the idea of opening the gates of understanding, as well as scrying the ethers of the earth in order to both, you know, abstractly understand, you know, God's mysteries, but also to spy on the Polish and various other European powers at the time. So it's this mixture of, like, very, very heady, very intellectual arch occult philosophy with some incredibly practical applications, potentially. The part that I have worked a number of angles on Enochian magic for a hot minute. I've worked some very, very crunchy, very Golden Dawn influenced, very complicated stuff. I've worked some far more kind of massaged and streamlined visionary stuff. Let me phrase that in a positive. I think that, say, for instance, like Lon Milo Duquette's Enochian Vision Magic is not actually a bad place for people to start. I think it's a great summary of some very complicated history. An awful lot of these texts only exist in part, or that we've lost since then, or that Dee destroyed himself famously, or were found by a servant after another servant had been using them to line pies and things like that. It's a weird and complicated and wonderful magical history of the texts and systems themselves. But I've worked a number of those kind of different approaches, and so I can, you know, give recommendations for that kind of thing. But for me, what's stuck is the language itself that a lot of this was communicated in. And honestly, you don't actually need to know anything about Enochian magic in order to use the calls in Nazarth. That was kind of the point, right? Is it was a one-stop shop for initially for my clients and students to have a resource that could cohere these things. And the reason it interests me so much partly is just in general, ritual languages are really useful for spirit work, to delineate different kinds of communication and things like that. But also, if we take seriously the reports of the spirits that delivered it to Dee and Kelly, it is meant to be the original language of creation. It is an Adamical language, which I think we were going to get into at some point.
Actually, yeah, that's the next question, really. And it's, I just made a note as well here saying language underline. Throughout your written work, you make a significant point of underscoring the importance of Adam. He arrives as one of the tutelary patriarchs to the infamous Humphrey Gilbert and John Davis in your An Excellent Book of Magic. And here in Nazarth, you describe the language of the angels themselves as Adamical. Could you say something about the importance of this ancient mythic figure in expressions of magic and the value of having a universal sacred language?
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason the angelical work of Dr. Dee is called Enochian, and to my knowledge, he doesn't refer to the work by that name, that's a name that gets appended later, is because he is searching for the books of Enoch. He is searching for the works of biblical ancestor of book magic, who is said to have communicated directly with God in the language of God, and then been subsumed into heaven and maybe got promoted to Metatron in some folklore. So the idea is he's looking for the lost works, these sacred wisdoms of just generally powerful magic, and then realizes that in order to be able to understand them, he's going to have to speak the language of angels. And so language becomes this other crucial component combined with his endeavors with scrying with a stone or a mirror or a variety of other showstones and scrying equipment. So he's invested in doing that. The other side of this is that when he starts receiving a language from these supposedly angelical spirits, and there's arguments as to how Christian or angelic the spirits of the Enochian system actually are. Certainly Dee was hoping they were. Is that they themselves refer to the language as Adamical. It's not just a natural language, as the term that gets used sometimes, this universal language that like everything can understand, that's the idea, but also that it's based around being the language that was spoken in Eden. It is an Edenic language, it's the language of Adam. And there is this big endeavor more widely in early modern occult philosophy to get at the true language of nature, and to be able, that we can't understand nature until we can speak its language. And that for Dee and for a variety of other occult philosophers and magicians, this the Enochian language, the angelical language, fulfilled those needs. And so you've got a variety of spirits throughout Dee's diaries saying that this is a language taught in paradise by infusion to Adam, that Adam spoke of all the animals properly, naming them properly by their natures, that these aren't just arbitrary mouth noises that he assigns to the animals. These are, in fact, deliberate emblems of their essential natures and of their descriptions. So time and time again, we have this idea that Adam, who is already considered to have had, I don't want to say a superhuman, but an ultra-human understanding of the world that's been loaded into him directly by God, that he has this supposedly perfect imbued knowledge, which allows him to have to understand and use all of the herbs and animals and stones and metals that are found in Eden, as well as being able to converse with all the animals, obviously, but all the spirits that are in Eden, including a bunch of daimones or even demons, including speaking to the winds again. And that... if we take seriously Enochian's own claims about its language, it provides us a set of tools for working with spirits that don't require an engagement with the other components of various Enochian systems.
So literally just employing the language itself.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I'm really fascinated by this idea of how in the mythological Adam, by naming things, he was dividing them from nothingness, in a sense. By, like you say, he the name themselves are almost like emblematic of the nature of the thing itself as well.
So you have a couple of things here that I think are super interesting. Firstly, there's naming is a kind of pacting, right? And I'm very interested in exploring how the first ancestor, the first father, the first magician, the first geomancer, according to an awful lot of Jewish and Islamic lore, is able to do these miraculous things and to already have these existing pacts that we too can appeal to when we work our animalia, when we work with animals, when we work with materia, right? There is a notion, certainly in the early modern, they're very interested in this being a symbol of Adam's dominion over nature, and this idea of this shows that we are patting ourselves on the back, God's most important specialist children, and we get to ruin the earth however we like, because damn it, we're in charge now. As opposed to a bunch of ideas around this being a pact of mutual agreement, there are arguments that refute this notion that that Adam's naming is about control and dominion, chiefly that they argue that, well, we still try and control animals after the fall. So if God takes away the blessings of prelapsarian humanity and we're still able to do this thing, that can't have been one of the blessings. And I think that's a really powerful argument. There's a lot of feminist critique around dominion as well, around what that means in terms of like equity and gender and things. But I'm especially interested in the idea that like he has established pacts that we can also appeal to, and that these pacts are about about working together. Again, remember before the fall, supposedly, you know, Adam and Eve are both like strict vegetarians. They have no use for wool or any of the pelts of these animals because they're, you know, not ashamed of their nakedness. They have no need for animals to to ride horses or anything like that. They can get to where they need to get to in time. And so exploring what it means, exploring what Adam means as a powerful ancestor for a start, like the full folk necromancy of this, go back to source, right? Go back to everyone's dad, as well as exploring what it means to work in harmony with spirits and as best we can with nature.
Okay, so what you're saying really is, for instance, Enochian, the language of Enochian itself can be used in this same method, in the same way that Adam used it specifically to cohere specific forces in nature and to muster specific virtues,
yeah,
to effectuate change.
Yeah, yeah, it instantiates the same virtues and coherences of interrelationality. Yeah, it is literally like a terroir of the speech of Eden, right? You are appealing in precedent. This has already been done, like classic conjurational kind of protocols there, as Adam did this. There are calls throughout early modern books of conjuration that say that conjure spirits specifically by the words that Adam heard and spake. So that's already like canon. This isn't me like just deciding to shove Adam into a bunch of things. Like he's right there, right? You know, one of the most famous, you know, folk heroes and demigods ancestors that we have. Yeah, so you are appealing to...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Something that's already been established, it can be understood and listened to. And again, like the Archangel Raphael, when he turns up in Dee's diaries and journals of this work, says like everything will understand this language. The oceans will tremble. The depths of hell, heaven shall move when they know their thunder. Hell shall tremble when they know what is spoken to them. And it's been my experience that I have yet to encounter a spirit that doesn't respond to the Enochian language. Not all of them are into it, especially some of the more, some of the prouder, unclean spirits of the Goetia. Because if we understand their biographies, they're fallen angels. You're speaking to them in the language of their hometown that they've been exiled from. And so that definitely gets a reaction. It's not always a positive reaction, but it does get them talking and in the room. And from there, we can calm them down or continue to exacerbate them as we're trying to do what we're trying to do.
So you've described geomancy in the text as the 16 4-bit binary figures that constitute the popular geomancy of the European Renaissance, which apply astrological understandings to earthly lots in a dialectic of elemental transmutation. Could you elaborate on this and exactly how somebody who's never approached divination at all could bring geomancy into their practice?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, so for a start, if we concentrate on the idea of like elemental transmutation or transformation, I'm very much drawing on inspiration from my friend and colleague Sam Block, who writes his Polyphonies on the Digital Ambler and does amazing work on geomancy amongst many other topics that he writes so eloquently on. And he talks about how the forms of the figures, and again, 2-bit binary 4-part structure might sound a bit confusing. If folks are familiar with the Yi Ching at all, and it's broken and unbroken lines, hexagrams, 6 lines of broken or unbroken, representing a a set of reiterations of different yin and yang of different elemental or cosmological forces. Geomancy does very much the same thing. It only has four instead of six. So it's like a travel I Ching. And each of those lines themselves for each figure is connected or understood via the elements. So each figure has a fire line and an air line, a water line and an earth line. And so the forms of the figures themselves are little maps of the what Sam calls like the theoretical alchemy of them, that they represent a description of a set of patterns of things that happen, right? And crucially, they are geomancy is particularly like singularly useful because it works with this very dialectic process whereby one pattern of energies is understood as literally meeting another and producing a synthesis. So this is true of like all divination, right? Like, you're represented at the moment by the Page of Cups, your boss is represented by the King of Wands. Here's how you guys are going to argue or get on, right? So it's always about finding the two things that are relating to each other and what the useful synthesis of that is. The trick with the thing with geomancy is that it's reduced to kind of the mathematical certainties of like, how you add the dots of the figures together, which is very hard to explain in audio only. And most books that don't have diagrams like spend an awful lot of time sounding very complicated. You can explain geomancy with a whiteboard or, again, to be traditional, a bunch of sand that you draw things in very, very straightforwardly. And so I'd recommend if people are interested, find a video of someone talking about it like that you can watch as well. I have a couple of them on YouTube. I'm happy to send you links for your audience too if they're interested. So geomancy, like many divinations, seeks to map the unfolding of nature. And it has some particularly dialectic ways of doing that, whereby this pattern of energy, say the moon's dynamism via the figure of like the rivering of lunar influences that can both be the riptide of the river and also its like shallow meandering kind of babbling, and represents shifts and sudden changes and things being up in the air. When that pattern of energy that marks something meets the martial geomantic figure or the pattern of energy that this martial geomantic figure of Pua produces, it will always produce the synthesis of Albus, a mercurial geomantic figure of wisdom. And so the we can derive lessons from this thing when the young warrior goes out onto the road and seeking the quest, he will eventually come to wisdom, right? So we can understand how these patterns always produce their syntheses. So it's actually a very straightforward system of divination to pick up and start doing. One of the reasons that it's a bit of a lacuna in many otherwise very studied practitioners is that it was so immensely popular by the 18th century that it kind of rendered itself redundant from so many books printing up ever more pulp, ever more streamlined, ever more simplified, ever more populist conception of it, because there was a demand for it, because people liked using it. And then at a certain point, a bunch of occult philosophers went, well, if even servant women are using it, then it can't be that good. And so it just got like kind of brushed to the side. And the Golden Dawn took some perfunctory interest in it, some practitioners more than others. But if you aren't aware of the importance of European Renaissance geomancy, which Agrippa calls like the most accurate divination and is immensely popular, that's not your fault. You've been badly served by our own history.
So essentially, it was no longer a cult, so it didn't have a mystique to it anymore. Interesting, exactly. I didn't know that.
Yeah. A victim of its own success in many ways, and the classism that underlies an awful lot of ceremonial magic, let's be honest. So I often liken it to bass guitar, which I've played in punk bands for many years and screamed in the background. It's really easy to pick up. It's really easy to play the root notes and to get a rough idea of like being able to play along. And it takes a lifetime to master the groove and syncopations and all of the specifics. So it's a system that people can pick up very quickly, especially if you have any basis in what gets called, you know, the fundamentals of Western occult philosophy, like the four classical elements, the seven classical planets, and particularly the schema of the 12 houses of heaven, which we use in geomantic shield charts.
I'm definitely going to have to remedy this because I think it's something that I need to be able to deploy in my day-to-day work. I primarily work with the tarot and astrology. Yeah, I think that's generally a good language system to have. But I think, like you said, having this ability to have a travel I Ching in your back pocket all the time is very useful. And I'm all about that, being able to have everything that you need in a small little bag. And you don't need anything else. Yeah, your little toolkit, and you can just go out into nature and do what you need to do.
Yeah, I have read geomancy with some very fancy consecrated wooden staves or sticks. That's the main tool I use. But I've also read it with four saint medals slammed up and down. I've read it with coins. I've read it with beer bottles, bottle tops. I've read it from the random numbers printed on my train ticket. It is incredibly easy to pull out figures. It's incredibly easy to generate the information that you will then synthesize into your reading and your wisdom from that reading.
So this isn't simply a methodology of divination. To quote you once more, in understanding the arising and affectivity of the figures, we may not only chart transfigurations, but actually shepherd intentional changes through operative geomantic sorcery. You continue, for from these forms, these haunted doorways of possibility and sigil nets that bind what is called forth from them, what new coherencies of reality may be ushered. And first of all, I just have to say that is a fantastic line. I really loved reading that. But could you explain something about that?
Yeah, so it's partly what I've already been banging on about how any divination system, I think, potentially at least, holds out the option to do operative sorcery with it, not just describing the world, but changing it in some way, seeking the path of least resistance, looking for the things that we can either appeal to, I mean, classically by either governance of like, you have a Saturnine problem, you should do some Saturn work about that to help get on Saturn's good side because it rules the things that are currently like buggering you up. Or, you know, cure by contrary. Oh, you have a Saturnine problem. Let's look for some lunar or Venusian remedies for that because you have an excess of these heavy leaden melancholy influences and you need some more like sanguine and even phlegmatic kind of influences going on. So the idea that any system of divination has the capacity to not just map, but not just map what's going on, but also to be able to locate useful magical remediations to move towards success and attempt to ameliorate or work around or work through obstacles and things like that. So specifically for me, again, being able to not just do a chart, do a shield chart that explains what's up with a client, but also looking for the things that they can do about that. From offerings to particular spirits to petitioning land spirits to doing baths, candle work, building charms for themselves, having talismans that they wear or that they bury in certain locations, wealth of the ways that we can actually work with these patterns of energies that are going on. The idea is that, you know, the divination gives you the sense of like what's happening. And ideally, we want to use our magic to get behind the wheel of that pattern of energy and not be hit by the car of it. So that's especially true sometimes of like bad news, right? A chart coming up saying like you are being held back by some haunted amulet that you just won't get rid of, right? Well, maybe get rid of that haunted amulet, right? That's you being, you know, this is common in geomancy when a figure of Cauda Draconis comes up, the dragon's tail, which in geomancy is pretty specifically bad news bears most of the time. It's a figure of destruction, of arson, of character assassination, of violent accidents. So if that figure turns up, we want to find a thing that we want to choose to destroy so that we aren't the ones being hit by the car of some random destruction or accident, right? So partly it's this sense of geomantic magic is just about helping people to work with what they have. And again, being able to read charts that say, hey, this is all up for grabs. Like you can change this versus like, no, this is more of a thing you need to endure for a while. And looking at those differences. The key about this thing around, not to belabor the point too much, but the key around the point of the haunted forms of the figures, the dots themselves, is partly just about, oh, potentially just, you know, little things like, you know, just turning the whole world upside down, right? And rather than seeing the influence of the stars from above, below, you know, cupping our bowl like Oliver asking for more, sir, to thinking about, no, we are working with the sublunary energies and virtues and spirits already present in the world that we live in right here. And so the idea of puncturing the earth with points to see what emerges from the earth upwards, right? The grassroots stuff of working sublunary nigromancies and chthonic sorcery, rather than these appeals to empyrean perfect ideal realms of heaven that might brush off some crumbs for us. Yeah, for me, this is very much about like grassroots folk magic and the basis of terrestrial and chthonic spirit work and sorcery. Yeah.
So moving on then, the number 19 plays a significant role in this text and in its reception. And I think it's fair to say that this is a received text. Could you describe for the audience the importance of gematria, and how did you deploy gematria in any way in this, in the construction of these calls?
Sure, yeah. So a lot of the calls are derived from an approach to the Enochian language, which is contained in a bunch of the things that get called the Enochian calls, of which there are 19. It uses an approach very similar to excerpting versicles from psalms. So not necessarily even using the whole psalm, just using a line from it or like a phrase from it in our practice. And so an awful lot of these calls don't just work with the individual words, they work with quotes from different calls. And one of them is about, you know, the central one is I've gathered pillars of gladness 19 and used them as vessels with which to water the earth and its creatures, which is the basis of the title, as well as like the kind of the whole deal with the book. And so Enochian's relationship with numbers and gematria, which is the practice of adding up the numerical values assigned to the letters of a word to be able to make comparisons between the meanings of words, as broad as we can get, is interesting because in some of those texts the numbers are added in later, so they come in kind of at random in some cases, and they're also like there's a certain suspicion reading them that some of them have some kind of like spurious rigor to them. So rather than just being like, oh, you first flames of the first highest, it now becomes, oh, you 4,962 first flames of the high. And you're like, this seems very specific. Okay. So it's 19 partly because those are the number of the calls, the 18 plus one that has a bunch of like male merge stuff in it so that you can work with the ethers. Again, we don't need to get into the technicalities of formal ceremony and Enochian magic. And then those 19 became a suitable number of a kind of completion, as well as understanding the 16 plus the 3 to make it operative, to begin, to end, and to clear something confusing.
So I understand that one of the primary inspirations for Nazarth was a pamphlet that you came into possession of called The Enochian Grimoire by Russell.
Yeah, so I found it in how do I frame this? That I came across this very short little digital pamphlet. I'm not sure if it ever existed in physical print, with a bunch of other treatises and writings and, you know, unfinished Word docs and things like that. Floating around the dingy alleys of the internet a number of years ago. I'm not sure exactly where it came from, honestly. And what I like about it is that half of it is about very tangible little charms that are also derived from this kind of versicle approach to the Enochian calls. So rather than formally reciting them as a ceremonial magician would, just exerting some of the lines about like, I conjure you fire when you light the candle, when you pour your libation. So these very simple, directed, practical charms that evoke the magics and pacts of the Enochian language in your own ritual process. The other half of it is about translating extant folk charms into Enochian, into the angelical language, which include anything from like love charms to protections. It's a very short work. I ended up tracking him down on the internets and asking him like what the deal was, and he was like, "Oh, I just made it. You know, it's just the thing." He didn't really have much to say beyond like, "No, I just did it, you know, for the sake of it." But that was really what one of the things that demonstrated to me and showed more than told that, yeah, you can absurd versicles from the.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
The wider and more specific ceremonial corpus of Enochiana for a bunch of very practical folk magical ends.
Interesting. I had this image in my head that it was a really ancient document and you'd found some old pamphlet that was published in like the 1700s or something.
I wish. No, not at all. No, it's a modern dude. As I say, it was in a collection of dodgy occult PDFs, basically.
Nice. But it sounds very interesting. But I had a look for it, but I couldn't find it. But perhaps I was looking in the wrong places, given my...
I'd send it along to you. I don't know if he ever sold it. Again, I can reach out to him again. He was like, I was like, "Oh, do you do much other stuff with Enochian?" And he's like, "No, not really." I was like very enthusiastic, and he was like very chill, shall we say.
Okay. So you quote Benjamin Rowe, author of The Enochian Magic Reference, underscoring that the use of Enochian is highly adaptable and highly adaptable by its very nature, and it's innovative. If someone were to pick up this Psalter of Paul's, how could they begin working with them in their personal practice? And is it necessary to be conversant in geomancy or the Enochian system to begin?
Nope, that's the idea. No, you don't need it. In fact, sidebar. The prayer of opening that I assumed was mostly for Enochian divination, but for geomantic divination, but never says so explicitly. I have a number of colleagues who are mediums who do like readings about people's dead and their spirit guides who also use it, who found it incredibly effective. So no, the basis of it was there were no instructions about like, here's how to do geomancy or here's how to work formal Enochian magic, because the point of it was that you don't need that stuff for this. It was meant to be a very practical thing. So how can people start with it? I think there's a couple ways. One would be, yeah, sure, you could get a reading from someone, and if it, you know, asking, you know, is there a particular figure I can, whose spirits I can appeal to try and get this thing done. The other side of it, for anyone who already like knows their natal chart or is any kind of experienced planetary magician, I would recommend you give the prayers of or the calls associated with the geomantic figures that rule that planet a little look, because like the zodiacal signs that offer this like day side and night side of the planet, the most planets rule two geomantic figures, which I think we can also think about as either the hands of the planet in the world or the feet of the planet as they walk across human space and time, the wandering ones after all, right? So let's pick an example. Say you do a lot of martial work, you know, a lot of work with Mars, the Red Lord of war, and you know, the blood flush of honest rage, all that business. The two geomantic figures that are ruled or fueled, I would argue, is probably a more accurate way of thinking about it, by Mars are Pua, the young warrior that we spoke about a little bit, who's very Joseph Campbell monomyth, young. You know, Sir Gawain or Luke Skywalker going out on his mission. It's full of enthusiasm and bravado and all the things that young men do. And the other side of it is Rubius, the figure we also talked about, the figure of like red alerts, of warnings, of poisonings, of deceit, all the scorpionic stuff. You know, the fun business. Very Blood Rave in Blade movie kind of territory stuff. And so those give you two very different takes on how Mars works in the world, right? So if you've already got some familiarity or with the way that Mercury works, then you can very much jump straight into working with the two mercurial figures of geomancy: Albus, the white, the sage, the scholar, the librarian. Mercury as librarian, scaffolding and structuring the infrastructures of information themselves. And Conjunctio, Mercury is two-faced devil at the crossroads, spinning his used car salesman patter and making deals and pacts. And so they offer a rich set of engagements with the effects and instantiations of the planetary virtues in the world. So yeah, going by planet can be good. Again, if you're a very elemental magician and you work with it, like I'm a water guy. I do all my things with water. Then geomancy, like the 12 zodiacal signs split into triplicities, has elemental quartets. So I was saying, like, I read Laetitia, the Jupiterian figure of joy and gladness and revitalization, as a watery figure, a la John Hayden, as opposed to some older Arabic forms which read it as a fiery figure, which both make sense. But yeah, you can explore it from a number of angles based off what you already know, because it is this like silent partner in the vast history of things that get called Western occult philosophy and magical practice. Like, it's right there, and you can keep finding it throughout. And it's continued to keep nurturing me as I've continued to keep exploring it.
I know the book has been out for a while already, but I think it takes a bit of time for it to sort of percolate into the wider community and for more and more people to start appreciating its value and understanding how to work with it. And I think I really hope that we're going to see a lot more material like this in the future, and we're going to see a lot more people using techniques like this in the future. It's definitely something I personally want to get involved with as well. I'm really interested in setting some time aside to actually like put this into action and try and see how this flows. I'm so fascinated listening to the way that you describe it and the way that it works, you work with it, that I think there's just a great opportunity to dive into something that has, like you said, this much more chthonic element, that has this much more earth-centric, sublunar vibe to the whole thing. And yeah, like working with the nature of the virtues of the world as opposed to distant celestial realms. Very much about that. I really, really enjoy it. So I'm excited to see how this is going to be received by people over time and how people are using it. So thank you so much for putting this book together, and I know it took a long time for you to do it as well, and there was a lot of process in bringing these calls together specifically, to cohere them, as you would say, to produce them. So yeah, thank you for that, Al. My final question then for today is, Al, what are you obsessed with right now at the moment? Is there anything that you're deeply passionate about that you want to talk about?
Oh, absolutely, mate. Yeah, I am very, very excited at the moment about ongoing work I'm doing with a short 16th century English grimoire which calls itself The Book of the Science of Nigromancy, which appears to be relatively popular in some forms across a bunch of different texts. You can find excerpts of it in Emu's 173. It was published relatively recently by Dan Helms et al. As of Angels, Demons and Spirits. There's some stuff in there. You find it in various manuscripts that people have looked less at, like the Chethams. And you also find it in Sloan Manuscript 3853 in the wider collection of texts referred to as the book called the Donnell, which I know you and I have spoken about a little bit before. It's a fascinating text because it draws on a very streamlined approach to conjuration, which is very familiar with a variety of nigromantic texts, which involves a formal initial pact with all the spirits in the system. And this grants you license to be able to send them out. And then the applied conjurations, once you've made that pact and got them all in your magic book that you literally open to send them out from by their characters, you use the applied conjurations to actually send them out to work. So it's an incredibly streamlined approach to this stuff. And you find that at least the applied conjurations more widely across, they revolve around catechtes, as they call them, or these like cryptograms that look rather like the sets of cryptograms you find in Faustian grimoires from that particular like German early modern oeuvre of more demonological works. They are also like sometimes said to be put around the circle in much the same way that yes, these German nigromantic texts do, but also clearly drawing on some influence from more formal medieval works like the Summa Sacra Magia or the Sworn Book. So it's derived from an awful lot of different sources, and these working groups of spirits called chapters are really fascinating because they represent some classic grimoric offices, like, you know, to go invisible, to have favor from great people, to war with your enemies. But there's a heavy emphasis on a couple things you don't see as often. It's a heavy emphasis on hunting, on being able to secure fish or poultry dinner, as well as a bunch of stuff around constructing magical items. So there's a whole group of carpenter spirits who you appeal to if you are making like works out of wood. There's stone working spirits in there. There's iron working spirits in there, as well as a kind of emphasis on just day-to-day living and surviving authority and power. There's a bunch of like stuff to escape from authority, to break people out of prisons, a lot more than the stuff around like how to advise the queen or how to like have an empire. And so for me, it looks like a very cunning work in the sense of like it deals with the folk magics of getting things done because you need to eat and keep a roof over your head. And so that very much appeals to me. And so I've been publishing work on that through my Patreon. And I'm going to continue to do that. I'm going to teach a class on it coming up. I have a bunch of cunning classes planned. I just finished a whole bunch looking at various aspects of cunning craft's approach to nature. So stuff on agricultural magic, on animals, on keeping livestock and looking after our pets and our house beasts, as one early modern text puts it, as well as like weather magic and a bunch of other stuff. So I have a bunch more classes coming up on cunning approaches to timing, to moon lore, to dreaming, to a couple of other bits and bobs like that. I'm going to continue doing new work on cunning craft, continue looking at the folk necromancy of a variety of these weird nigromantic grimoires, and I'm continuing to put out detailed studies of the delineations of the 16 geomantic figures across the 12 houses of a full shield chart. So looking at not just what does poor, our young warrior, mean? Well, it depends where he is in the chart. If you find him in the second house, which rules money, it's saying don't forget your wallet. If you find him in the, you know, so there are actually 192 different delineations that we can start to get. So learning the bass guitar of like, there are four sets of figures. Each of those sets has four figures in it. There are 16 figures. I know my 16 figures. I know my 12 houses. Now, if I relate them, I now know 192 different ways of thinking about the nuance of how those virtues and spirits are going to play out in the world. So I'm continuing to write about that. I'll say to you, because I think we've talked about it in private briefly, I'm planning on announcing a four-part course on the Grimorium Verum, which has been something that's very dear to me, is like one of the absolute foundational bases of my Goetia and my cunning more broadly. And I've been very wary about teaching more formally, but the time has come, and I'm really excited to be doing that. Keeping up a Patreon's been really fun, really grateful for everyone supporting me there. It means I get to spend more time delving into more grimoires and helping people unpick bits and pieces, continuing to look at like folk magical approaches to grimoire work of not just how do we do the big formal everything and the kitchen sink version, but how do we do the version that you just need to get by with, you know? And that doesn't have to be a simplification or a corruption or a because you don't want to do the whole thing. It doesn't have to be that kind of like slovenly approach. It can just be what's sufficient, you know, not over egging our puddings all the time. So yeah, very excited to be doing that. Have a bunch more classes and courses coming up.
Yeah, so you're a very busy guy, right?
Sometimes.
I'm very interested in the text on nigromancy that you mentioned, especially the jailbreaking. That sounds really cool. So if I were if people in the audience want to find you, how can they go about doing that?
I'm up on the gram, like a cool guy. I'm on the Instagrams as Grimoires on Tape. You can also find more of the specific classes and books and things like that on my Linktree, which is Linktree/Grimoires on Tape as well. You can head over to my website, which is imaginatively titled alexandercummins.com, which has lists of publications as well as the archive of all my many, many, many class recordings and course recordings that folks can buy as recordings to watch in their own time. I'm happy to, I'll share links with you and stuff so folks can keep abreast as they'd like. And yeah, if anyone's moved or interested in any of this, then I would consider it a deep kindness to check out what's going over on my secret library of the Patreon as well.
So thank you so much for taking the time to discuss this joyful work with us, Al. It's been a real pleasure, and I'm really looking forward to seeing more from you in the future.
Thank you so much, Matt. This has been brilliant to get to talk about this in trying to put this book of calls out without confusing people or telling them they needed to jump through a million hoops. There's not a lot of instruction about how to use them, and so it's really good to get to talk about and get to relate some of the things that students and clients who've reached out to me have already been experimenting with, like the mediums and things like that. So I'm really grateful to get to talk about this work and hopefully encourage some folks to play around with it.
That was Dr. Alexander Cummins discussing the multifaceted practice of divination and magic through the haunted doorways of the geomantic figures and use of the Enochian language. His book, Nazarth, Pillars of Gladness, is a beautifully and painstakingly received and crafted text which aims to both aid and develop the sorcerer's approach to divination. While I have yet to properly work with geomancy, I am inspired through Dr. Cummins' work and words to dive in and begin learning to apply this earth-centered form of divination to my own practice. I think it's difficult to not be moved by listening to Dr. Cummins' passion on the variety of subjects which came together to produce this book. His love for the subject is contagious, and this isn't the first time that he has personally moved me to explore something new. For those of you interested in learning more about Dr. Cummins and his work, links to Nazarth and his pages can be found in the description below. I am particularly interested in his upcoming projects, and I'm sure it won't be too long until he returns to the podcast to tell us more about those in detail. Please subscribe to the podcast, like our videos, comment and share if you can. We are really close to hitting our goal of 1,000 subscribers, so please share this video and our other videos with your friends if you know anyone that would be interested in the subjects of magic, divination, and occult philosophy. It would mean the absolute world to all of us at Hadean Press. I really hope that you enjoyed our conversation today, and I look forward to seeing you all again in